Thank you, Robin. Good afternoon, everyone. Good morning to some, I'm sure, and early morning to others. Thanks so much for joining us today. And as always, it's such a pleasure for us to work with Robin Jones and with the ADA Network of Centers. Robin's her booth is just a real class act, and it's always a joy to work with them. So what I'm going to do is I'm not going to take a whole lot of your time. What I would like to do is just give you an update in a few areas, and then we'll go right to questions and answers. You'll ask the questions, and hopefully I will have the answers. And if I don't, I'll make sure that I find them and get them to you. What I thought I would start with is in education and our work with education. And lately, it seems like it has been related to service animals, 24/7. So there are two cases. The first case, and you probably know about it, and you can find these on our website, ADA.gov, is the Gates Chilai case. And this was a public elementary school here in Rochester, New York. And there is a child who has a number of disabilities, and one of it is called Angelman syndrome. And she uses a service animal that basically it alerts her to when she might have a seizure. It keeps her from eloping, wandering, or running away. And also, it provides her stability for mobility so that she can move from place to place. And she, because of her disability, she may need occasional help in actually tethering the animal. And at times, giving some very short, very simple verbal commands. The school would not allow the service animal to come into the school unless either the student's mom came in to function as the handler, or the mom paid for someone to come in. And the other thing is this student already has a one-on-one aide due to the severity of her disabilities. And they, the mother worked with this school district for quite some time and thought that perhaps that the one-on-one aide that was already working with this student could tether the animal and untether it, occasionally when it's needed, and to assist with the student's instruction of the animal. Now, this was originally filed, we started investigating cases in August of 2013. So it's now January of 2016, and the student is 3 years older and has grown a lot more comfortable and able to handle the animal in terms of giving verbal commands. So 3 years makes a real difference. So we filed a lawsuit alleging that the school did, under Title II of the ADA, we're talking strictly here Title II, did have an obligation to provide occasional assistance, and that wasn't tantamount to providing direct care or supervision of the animal. Summary judgment, December 21st, the defendants filed a motion for summary judgment, and our response is due by mid-February. So I guess what I'm saying is this continues, but just keep your eyes peeled for this. And in addition, there is another lawsuit that a statement of interest that the Eastern District of New York filed, and this is really brand new, a 12-year-old child with multiple disabilities against SACHEM, S-A-C-H-E-M, Central School District Board of Education. And it is very, very similar to the Gates guideline. So just sort of, that's a brand new one. So I just want to alert you to the fact that that, in fact, statement of interest was filed less than a month ago. So keep your eyes open for this as well. But I know that there are a lot of folks, I think Robin had mentioned, folks, you know, perhaps working for secondary schools and, you know, perhaps elementary and other public schools. And service animals is a huge issue. It has not gone away. We get questions, you know, probably more than anything else in about service animals in virtually every context that you can imagine. So we are still working on getting the word out. If you haven't seen it, I encourage you to take a look at the technical assistance document that we did. It's questions and answers on service animals that goes a little bit deeper and touches upon issues that we didn't address in our first 2010 revision document on service animals. So I encourage you all to look at that and also to call the information line if you have questions, and to call the ADA centers as well. Moving along with education, we are very, very interested in ensuring that accessible technology is accessible and usable by people with all kinds of disabilities. Typically, you think about folks who have vision disabilities or who may be deaf, especially in terms of when you have videos. But it also includes folks who have fine motor issues in navigating any website. You know how they time out, and it's very frustrating. But in terms of sort of education, last September, hang on one second, I want to make sure. We filed the complaint and then we ultimately have settled the case, and it's the United States versus NX, and it's lowercase e, and then an uppercase X, and I got to tell you, I had no idea what any of this stuff was, and now I can actually say it, like I almost know what I'm talking about, but I really don't. But NX is a huge... basically, it's a consortium that was created by MIT and Harvard years ago, and it was, you know, nonprofit platform for universities to offer these MOOCs, M-O-O-C-S, which I'm sure you all know, massive open online courses, and their learning platforms. This one is really interesting. This is our first foray into the field of, you know, sort of online education that may be available across the board, not necessarily connected with specifically with a university and to students at that university. They started with 36 charter members, and they were no slouches. I mean, we're looking at Berkeley, Dartmouth, Caltech, the Sorbonne, Georgetown, and Peking University, among others. And there are now 60 universities and institutions that are basically offering more than 400, usually they're free courses, on all kinds of subjects, sciences, businesses, social sciences, and back then we estimated there were more than 3 million learners. Unfortunately, these wonderful free courses were inaccessible to folks with disabilities. And so we did reach an agreement with them, and they agreed to modify the website and their platforms and mobile apps to conform with WCAG 2.0 AA. And they would also provide guidance and authoring tools for people that are guest posters or guest visitors. So this was our first step into this world. We are looking at others. Of course, I can't say anything right now, but technology is just, it's not only the way that we learn, it's the way that we socialize, it's the way that we do business, it's the way that we participate as full members of our community. So we are terribly interested in accessible technology, especially accessible technology that, you know, has accessibility built in from the beginning. As you know, add-on stuff rarely work, or they rarely work well. This is an area that we're really interested in. One sort of quasi-education thing, this is sort of youth recreation, and we settled a really neat little case of Pikes Peak Wrestling League. And it's in Colorado, and there was a young man who basically had a number of issues that affected his skeletal system and cartilage and things like that, and he requested to what's called play down an age limit, an age group. So it was originally denied, but we basically worked with them. We reached a settlement agreement. Because what they had failed to do was to look at this on a case-by-case basis. And rather than having sort of a blanket across-the-board rule without any assessment, they just said, no, we can't do it. We've always done it this way. But they failed to do that individualized assessment. And the kid is now wrestling, having a great time, and it's just sort of a nice case that any of you who deal with youth sports leagues might want to pay attention. And again, it's Pikes Peak Wrestling, Youth Wrestling League. Let me see. I don't want to take up too much time because I know you have questions. Okay, how about our Olmsted work? And I'm sure you're wondering about that. I'm assuming that you know about Olmsted and what it is, but just in case there's someone who doesn't, Olmsted was a 1999 Supreme Court ruling that basically said unnecessary segregation. In this case, it meant unnecessary institutionalization in and of itself violates the ADA. And so since that time, we have, especially in the last 8 years, have really devoted a great deal of time and staff to work on systemic issues that initially we really dealt with getting folks out of institutions that didn't need to be there, wanted to be in the community, and getting the proper supports. So it sort of puts a real traditional moving someone from an institution to a community-based setting with the appropriate supports that were needed. And we did a number of those cases. And recently, well, it isn't that recently because these do tend to go on for a while. We are also looking at not just where people lay their head at night, but what is it that they do during the day? Are they given the opportunity to participate in stimulating integrated environments, integrated day settings, integrated employment? And so we did our first case in terms of, you know, the work environment was our case in Rhode Island. And it was against the state, it was against the city of Providence. And that basically got folks out of these sort of never-ending, quote, training program, and just kept people, many of them for 20 or 30 years, earning below minimum wage, some as little as, you know, 15 or 20 cents an hour, and worked to stop that systemic sort of shuffling of folks with disabilities into these kinds of centers, work environments solely with people with disabilities, and to work to provide support within the communities, and job coaches, those kinds of things. And that was the first one that we did. And it affected, hang on, I'm going to tell you just how many. About 3,200 people with intellectual and developmental disabilities who were unnecessarily sheltered, you know, placed in segregated sheltered work jobs, were working so that they can find full integrated employment to the extent that they're able to do it. And following up on that, we filed the case in Oregon, and this is huge. Again, it was you know, people, almost 7,000 people were with, again, it's with intellectual and developmental disabilities, were basically forced to work in sheltered workshops, segregated sheltered workshops, and sub minimum wage, all of those things. This past August, we reached a consent decree. It was just approved by the court on December 29th, 2015. And what this will do is it's going to, I'm going to read this to you. The agreement calls for 1,115 people that are currently in sheltered workshops will receive jobs in the community at competitive wages over the next 7 years, and the delay is to make sure that there are community supports. And in addition, 7,000 people will receive real employment services that will give them the opportunity to work in the community. And there's almost 5,000 of these folks are 14 to 24 years old and are leaving the school system. So that was a very cool thing. And it was just approved by the court less than a month ago. And I think really the last thing, I hope you guys are doing okay, two more things. One is I wanted to let you folks know that we have a real interest in ensuring that parents and prospective parents with disabilities aren't discriminated against in their ability to become parents and to teach their children, to adopt, you know, all of those kinds of things. And, you know, the rate that people with disabilities who give birth to children, the rate that people lose their kids within, you know, literally like the first week of their lives is astoundingly high for folks with developmental disabilities, folks who are deaf, folks with mental illness, intellectual disabilities, and for folks who have physical disabilities. So we issued a letter of finding to the, and for some of you this is going to be old news. It was in Massachusetts, it was the Department of Health and Human Services and their MassDCF, Department of Children and Families. And this was a young woman with an intellectual disability, and she had a child, and within 2 days, the welfare agency, DCF, just removed the child from her because her mom had an intellectual disability. Well, the mom was living with her mother, so grandma was around, very able. And what they didn't do was to the assessment of you know, here are the services we offer all new parents, but how do you offer them in a way that was meaningful and would have provided the intended assistance that the programs provided for everyone else? We were successful in helping, we weren't the only ones, to reunite this little girl with her family, and grandmother's involved, and mom is involved, and things are going really, really well. So that was our first official look into that. We're interested in getting matters that, you know, are alleging similar things, because we think that this is very systemic and that it occurs all over the place. And then I think the last thing I'm going to talk to you about or be talking to you about, and trust me, I will take you free very quickly, just an idea of what we did in technical assistance this year. We have done a number of new technical assistance documents, and a couple more are should be launched very soon. In the area of voting, we did two documents on voting last September and October, and hopefully we're revising and retooling the voting checklist. We are also reworking our emergency preparedness and emergency management stuff. We did documents on parenting. All of these are on our website, and this was a document that we did with HHS and I think it was Adult Family Services. We also did a document, with Department of Ed about effective communication in public elementary and secondary schools. We did a primer for Title II entities. As I mentioned earlier, we did the service animal questions and answers to dive a little deeper. We did a document on testing accommodations. We advised and sort of gave a new facelift to a brochure on the rights of folks with HIV and AIDS. And did supplemental guidance with the Department of Transportation on street resurfacing. And the issue here is, when does street resurfacing constitute an alteration requiring and triggering curb ramps and other obligations under the ADA? We responded to about 53,000 calls on our ADA information line, and I think we had about 33 million hits on ADA.gov. So keep calling us, keep finding us on ADA.gov, and we'll do our best to get you the information you need. And now I think I'm going to turn it back over to Robin.
Great. Thank you, Sally. I appreciate that overview, and I think people also appreciate that information from you. It just gives you a little idea of what's happening. And per usual, it sounds like you folks are more than busy.
We are.
That's a good thing. So at this time, we'll go ahead and start to take questions from our audience. We have a few that have already been submitted through the webinar platform, but let me just have the operator give a cue to those on the phone so we can start to get them in queue as well. So why don't you go ahead.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or comment at this time, please press the star and then the one key on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Once again, if you have any questions or comments, please press star, then one. I'm on for questions.
Sally, while we're waiting for the questions on the phone, there's someone here who's asking for an update on what's happening, if anything, with the Georgia GNET investigation. Is DOJ interested in more information for parents and students for that complaint?
That's a really good question. We are still very actively involved.
Can you give a little overview, because most folks don't know what that means. So.
Yeah, it's, hang on, I want to make sure that I'm right. Ugh. please hold. Talk amongst yourselves. I want to get to the correct information. Take me by surprise. Hang on. Can we get right back to that one?
We can come back to that one if you want to take a few minutes. Yeah, sure. Well, let me just go back and check to see whether or not there's anybody who queued into the telephone at this point for a question. Operator, was anybody?
Yes, we have a question from Jerry Adler. You may proceed, sir.
Hi. I just want to know if the ADA distinguishes between a therapy animal and a service animal and how the legal differences are.
Can you give clarification when you say therapy animal? Because therapy animal is often used for things like animals that are taken into nursing homes or to other kinds of places where the animal is playing a therapy role with people. So can you just get a clarification of what you're specifically asking?
Well, there's that situation. Also, there's therapy animals for individuals where they use the animal for therapy and need them to function daily, but they're not classified, quote unquote, as a service animal.
Right. Okay. So, Sally, you're okay with that, the way that it's there?
Yeah. Yep. Okay. I am. And I actually have an answer. You know, I think, Robin, your point of clarifying therapy animals is a very good one. So there is a very clear distinction. The Department of Justice, especially in the revised 2010 regulations, did a couple of things to try to clarify and also try to minimize the backlash that people with disabilities who use service animals were getting. The first was that we limited the species to dogs. But it has always been the department's position that in order to be a service animal, that animal has to have been individually trained to do work or perform tasks on behalf of that person with a disability. One thing I want to make clear, and I think I do it all the time, but it's not the service animal that has protection. It is the individual with a disability who entities need to modify a no pet policy to allow someone who uses a service animal that has already been trained to perform a very specific task. And we also made it very clear, because I think that we love to categorize things. And I think maybe sometimes things are put in the wrong category. And I think as soon as somebody heard, I have a psychiatric disability, they immediately thought, oh, this is a comfort animal. We made it really, really clear that an individual who has a psychiatric disability can absolutely benefit from the work or task that that animal has been trained to do specific to them. Emotional support, comfort, therapy, companion animals are animals that, by their very nature, can help someone who, may have trouble going out in public and becomes very anxious. And the mere presence of that animal can do something for that person that makes it easier for them to function. That animal has not been trained to do something specific. I think it also makes it hard because the ADA is one civil rights law for folks with disabilities, but other kinds of laws, great many state laws, have very different protections. They will allow or cover the emotional support animal. Air Carrier Access Act has very broad coverage, and apparently it includes turkeys. I thought I saw in the news. So the ADA, for purposes of people with disabilities, the ADA in order for them to assert their rights to modify no pets policy, they have to be a person with a disability. That animal has to be trained to individually trained to perform a specific task or do work to that are directly related to that individual's disability. Emotional support animals, companion animals, therapy animals, that group of animals have not been individually trained to perform a specific task, so therefore they are not covered by the service animal definition.
Thank you.
Great, thank you. We'll go back to our care platform, and then we'll look to see if any other questions come in on the telephone as well. So, yes, we're in the vein of service animals, and sometimes once you open this door, it's hard to shut it.
Very hard to shut it.
So here's another question related to service animals. Can you provide any guidance on the ability of Title I and II, Title II and III entities to ask about service animals' vaccination compliance? There's another caveat with that. Our operating position has been that a transient or one off-counter, such as questions, are improper. However, for long-term relationships, like in a hospital ER admission setting, for example, questions about vaccinations may be appropriate. Can you share your view on this issue, please?
I will. If you look at our questions and answers, that new service animal document, we have said that if a jurisdiction requires all dogs to be vaccinated, the fact that an animal is a service animal does not exempt them from that. So they have to comply with those jurisdictional laws and ordinances. So, I mean, we had said that a dog that's a service animal does not get a pass if the jurisdiction has a requirement for vaccinating all dogs within that jurisdiction.
So does that, just for clarification in the person's question, does that mean then that a Title II or III entity, if they're in a jurisdiction that requires vaccination of animals, in this case dogs, that they would be okay to ask for vaccination records? Are there any caveats on that?
Well, the whole issue of what kinds of documentation is, as you know, it's a touchy one. I think that as soon as anybody goes down the road of asking for documentation, just be very, very careful. Because an entity could ask, has your dog been vaccinated? You know, and if the dog has a tag, that's documentation. But as soon as we start going down the, and I wouldn't say this if I hadn't heard it so many times. Very often what will happen is not just a request for proof of vaccination. Like I have to provide to the city of Alexandria here to get my tag. Not for me, for a pet. But what often happens is it's also, while you're at it, how about all the medical records? Show me everything else about your animal. So that's the caveat that I have. I fully understand in long term where, you know, if it may be in school housing, if it's, you know, somebody that's going to be on campus for a whole semester. But beware of what you ask. And, you know, if there are other folks that come in with pets or non-service animals, let's just leave it at that, what is it that you ask of them? So, yes, you can ask for proof of vaccination, but just be awfully careful about what other stuff gets wrapped up in that. Does that make sense?
I think that does. Again, I think you're given the cautionary that be careful for what the reason is you're asking for it,
yep.
And that you can defend why it's needed, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, again, you're talking about, you know, why an entity has determined that it's necessary, but also that it's consistent with what that entity in that jurisdiction requires of everybody else when disability is out of the equation. That's the key.
Yep. Great.
Okay.
Good. Thank you. Let's go back and see if there's anything else that's coming on the phone. Is there anything from the phone from the operator, Ethan?
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions or comments, please press the star and then the one key on your touchtone telephone.
Great. Thank you. We'll wait to see if anybody queues up. There's a question here coming online. This is an individual who identifies themselves as an advocate, and they're asking, what can they do to maximize the chances that DOJ will look into a complaint? For example, someone I know recently filed a complaint regarding the lack of pool lifts in a fitness chain with brand new pools. DOJ declined to pursue it. There's not many options in my state for alternative enforcement opportunities. What else can be done?
It's really hard. The first thing is, and I'm going to be completely honest, we get tons and tons of complaints. And we can't open every single one of them. We can't open most of them. Thousands and thousands of complaints. So I think there's a couple of things. One is, And as a person with a disability, I get it completely. And I think that the vast majority of complaints that we get, people really have tried to work it out locally before they come to us. And I know that it's tiring. There aren't a whole lot of options, especially if you talk about Title III complaints. Because they're, private complaints, there aren't any damages really that are available. And it becomes harder and harder. If there is a complaint against a chain of entities, whether it's a hotel, some kind of a fitness center, make that very clear to us. It just gets really, really hard, and it leaves people completely understandably frustrated and feeling, is there no justice? And I think certainly making, contacting the protection and advocacy organizations in each state, but again, I think, they certainly have their staffing capacity issues, they have different priorities, and it all depends on that. I don't have a whole lot of brilliant information for you.
Sometimes using other methods, such as using the press and other ways to get attention to those things. If it's been something that's newly been constructed, especially if you're in a state that might also have a building code like IBC or something that does include some of these things in it, I think it's also looking to use your local building codes and other enforcement mechanisms than just DOJ for the ADA as well.
Absolutely. And while I can't, Robin's point about making the problem known is an excellent point. And I think, too, that depending where you are, your state or your municipal anti-discrimination laws may also be possible to use.
Right. Sometimes you've got ordinances or something locally that this kind of thing might fall under as well. Yeah.
And state, either state human rights commissions or civil rights commissions, Before I came to DOJ, I had been one of my many, I was on the three-year plan, jobs was to investigate complaints at the New Hampshire Commission for Human Rights. And we had, you know, public accommodation, state agencies, employment, and housing. And that's always an option.
Right. Definitely look to what might have locally for sure, but definitely understand, I mean, there's concerns across all federal agencies when it comes to enforcement, unfortunately. Okay, we'll go back. I have another online question here. This person lives in the city. The city engineer has told them that each homeowner is responsible for fixing any sidewalks that need repair. It's sidewalks in the subdivision where they live is very uneven. They said that so the city's divided up into sections, and there's a section to have work done on the sidewalks, but it will come out if there's a complaint for only one uneven spot until it is your time for your section to be fixed. They won't do anything. Is there anything related to the ADA that would specifically address this, or do you have any thoughts on that issue?
These are really hard ones. And I know that, you know, when I first came to work with DOJ, I'd never heard of things like this. And I think, for example, I don't know if anybody's from Pennsylvania, but I think this is a very common municipal practice to essentially tell homeowners that wherever your property abuts, you may be responsible for maintenance of the sidewalk. You may be responsible for paying for the installation of a curb ramp, and also, you know, shoveling and things like that. So if in fact this area is owned by the municipality, and it is not, in fact, private property. And there's a big difference when something is private property within a development. The city probably has no jurisdiction there because there's a private street, private sidewalk, and all of those things. But there is something in Title II basically says you can't contract away your rights if you are entitled to any. So whoever ultimately has authority over those, you know, sidewalks, driveways, all of those things, it's city property. And their method of administration may be to sort of divvy out who has responsibility for doing what, but it's still, as long as it's city property, it's their obligation to ensure that, you know, the maintenance of accessible features, that there are curb ramps, and that, you know, terrible sidewalks that get all broken up get fixed. How they do it is up to them. If it's their property, it is ultimately the city or the town's responsibility.
Great. Thank you. I know that's a tough one because people do struggle with this particular issue with their sidewalks, longstanding. Never enough money to fix them all either. So.
No, there isn't, and you know you have hard winters, and you get frost heaves, and then you know the tree roots come out. I mean, it's just a never ending thing. But I think the bottom line is if the municipality owns the sidewalk and has authority over them, it is ultimately them that has the obligation. They may try or may through ordinance assign different people things, but you know, a homeowner is not a covered entity under the ADA. If a homeowner has responsibility, it is the city. And I think knowing what is private property, even though it looks like it isn't, But just remembering that if the city has authority over that walkway, it is the city's responsibility.
Here's another question come in, one that's thanking you for the useful information. They're also coming with us. They're happy to hear about the DOJ statement of interest in the Boise case challenging anti-camping ordinance. The question is, does DOJ plan other activities around homelessness? And does DOJ currently have resources to investigate new complaints on this particular issue?
We are very, very, very interested in the entire issue of homelessness and the criminalization of homelessness. If people, you know, we're certainly interested in hearing about circumstances like the Boise issue. We are looking at a number of things right now, and of course I can't say a word. But the whole idea of homelessness and the criminalization of homelessness is incredibly important to us. If there are complaints, people should get them to us.
That's a good recommendation. Are there any questions coming from the telephone at this time?
Yes, we have a question from Don Philippon. You may proceed.
Yes, are there any special requirements of colleges to provide special career-related services when it comes to helping those that may have some issues using normal services of the Career Center?
I'm not quite sure, but I think here's the thing that a college or a university, whether it's community college, four-year college, postgraduate, needs to make sure that the services that it offers all its students are accessible to your students with disabilities. And that may mean modifying policies. It may mean providing effective communication. Each of those, if it's Title II, that clearly is the program within that Title II entity. And if it's a private school, and we have jurisdiction under Title III, and the ADA applies, they need to modify policies, practices, and procedures when it's necessary to ensure that folks with disabilities can participate in that service. And certainly the limitation of the defense would be that it would be a fundamental alteration for these reasonable modifications. That's an incredibly high standard. I wonder, do you have any additional information that might be helpful in answering to benefit everybody of what specifically you might be asking?
So it might be career coaching, developing their resumes, helping them in mock interviews and things like that.
A school needs to make sure that a person with a disability can participate in those. Those are offered to all the students, and the eligibility criteria to participate is probably, maybe you're a certain year in school, you're carrying at least X amount of credits. If whatever eligibility criteria you have to participate in that career counseling, it has to be made available to students with disabilities to the same extent.
Just for clarification, the school, if they don't provide those to any student, would not specifically have an obligation to provide those to students with disabilities. I think that's
Sorry. If it's not a service that you provide, you are not required to provide that service to students with disability. My sense would be, though, if you are offering disability student services or student disability services, however that office may be defined, that is probably something that that disabled students organization or center would automatically provide. But if it's not a service provided to anybody else, there is no obligation under the ADA to do so.
That might be best practice to look at that and how students with disabilities might be disadvantaged in accessing some of the other programs. And whether or not some specialized, for example, that students who might particularly have, difficulty with, approaching and you know, due to their disability, have some limitations in their social skills and things of that nature, maybe making some modifications or offering some alternatives. But again, it would then go tied back to what services am I providing students without disabilities. Just want to make sure we're clear here that it's not specialized services that would be under ADA required.
Correct. Exactly. And we always remember there's nothing, the ADA is a floor, and if you don't offer a service, you are never required to offer a service to somebody with a disability. I mean, throughout the ADA, it's really, if it's provided, you have to make sure that it's accessible and usable and helpful to students with disabilities. But yes, as Robin said, certainly a best practice for students with all kinds of disabilities. If you have someone with who may be, on the autism spectrum, if you have somebody who has a communication disability, all of those things, there are going to be additional issues that they have to deal with every time they even contemplate going on a job interview.
Great. Thank you. Now we have a question. Again, this goes back to the complaint issue and back to the questions submitted through the webinar platform. This is someone saying, I've attempted to file a complaint against Ticketmaster/Live Nation approximately 6 months ago. Unfortunately, I was told by DOJ that they could not take my complaint at that time. After doing some research, however, I found that DOJ filed against Ticketmaster in 2005 for the same exact issue I've been having with them. Is there any continued update on this settlement with Ticketmaster from 2005? They were following them for 2 years afterwards, according to what I found in my research. But since dealing with the same things now, so many years later, I'm wondering if there's anything else that can be done to help address the issues with disabilities attending events and attending tickets.
Yeah, we did have that agreement. It seems like it was way back. But that agreement, to my knowledge, has expired.
Right, I think she's saying her research shows 3 years. So
it would have been for, and I'm just saying that I think in fact it's right. So if the question that did you file a complaint and we just sent you a letter and said unfortunately we're unable to open this investigation?
Yeah, they're not taking something else for me. They said that they did not take my complaint at this time. I don't know if they're going to put any more additional information in the platform or not for us on what it said.
Yeah, if there's additional information and I can get it, I can follow up on that.
Okay. So if the individual who asked that question wants to provide us some additional information, including your contact information, we can pass that on to Sally, and she can help follow up on that particular issue. But do you have any other words of advice or anything related to individuals who might be experiencing problems? So she said she received a letter in December of 2015 stating that they are not able to take the case.
I wish we didn't have
probably a constraint. Is that a constraint of your investigative staff?
It is really due to staffing constraints. Absolutely. But if there's additional information and somebody, if you could forward it to me, Robin.
Sure. Just ask that person to give us some additional information.
Yeah.
Privately through the webinar platform. It's not seen by anybody else, and we'll make sure to get that information to Sally to follow up with. That sounds good. Let's see. Here's another question. Oh, let me go back to the phone. Is there any other additional questions from the telephone at this time?
Yes, we have a question from Susan Webb. You may proceed.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for taking my call. I wonder if this has already been addressed previously. I appreciate you needing complaints that are specific and about national chains, but there's something happening in the hotel industry that is pretty much widespread among all the chains, and that is the height of the beds in guest rooms. They have all gone to these high pillow top beds that are like climbing Mount Everest. And I suspect you know about this complaint. I understand that the Access Board cannot provide any kind of accessibility guidelines for furniture. They can only do it for fixed environment. But you do have in the regulations about distance between beds in lodging facilities, and I'm curious as to whether something, I know this is a long time problem for a lot of people, and I think I heard you say right, so are you working on this already?
Here, yes. And first of all, you know, Mount Everest, especially if I get older, is an understatement.
Well, as a wheelchair user, I can tell you perhaps it is, but I didn't want to sound too exaggerated.
No, and I am also one. It's a huge issue. We are going to be addressing hotel beds as its own regulation.
Good.
It was earlier put into equipment and furniture. It was a very big, massive NPRM. And actually, hotel beds got put out of that. It is currently listed on the unified agenda, the regulatory agenda for the federal government, as I'm not sure if it's an ANPRM or an NPRM, but in April of next year. It is a specific issue that we are looking at from a regulatory perspective, because right now there's not a blessed thing you can do to stop it. Because the standards don't apply.
Right, exactly. Other than a modification of policy,
right,
practice or procedure that you can ask them. But what I find is that either they can't do it, or even if they do, then it becomes too low and they think the box springs out.
Yep.
And then it's too soft because it has no support. And then you need the space under the bed to use the Hoyer lift. So it's really a problem, and I'm glad that you're addressing it.
It's a huge problem. You know, and my fellow baby boomers, I think, you know, getting these pillow soft, you know, things you lie into and you sink into like a hot dog roll, you know, we're responsible for that, I think. But it also, the height is just, it's just absolutely unwieldy. And also when they started using the platform bed rather than having room underneath, you know, really had a deleterious effect on folks who were using any kind of a Hoyer or other such lift to transfer in and out of bed. But this is something that is absolutely on our radar screen, and there are a number of us here that we have to travel a fair amount, and every time we come back, we're screaming about it.
Yeah, you know, I'm in that boat too,
yep,
and lots of others are as well.
Yep.
Well, I'm glad you're working on it, so it's going to be another year or so before we see anything, but it's coming.
It is being worked on by our legal regulatory team.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the info.
I also know that there's a lot of advocacy groups that have been meeting and talking to different hotel chains across the country directly about this particular issue and trying to get support and buy-in from them that this really is an issue in their rooms and something that they should be concerned about and that they should be addressing, you know, proactively. So, you know, that's another route. It's not always about the regs because it does take time for the regs to push through, but I think if customers continue, advocates and others in your communities have opportunities to, you know, have that dialogue and discussion with the hotel chains. I think that that continued voice also is really important in this issue.
Can you tell me about any of those groups who they might be?
Well, I do know that the through the ADA National Symposium, they have been working with Hyatt. I know another group that has been working directly with Marriott and are trying to do this as well. The ADA National Network has a hospitality initiative, and I know that they've had several conversations also with hotel chains. So,
so you've got the ADA National Symposium and the ADA National Network. Those are two different things?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, they're connected together. The ADA National Symposium is coordinated by the Great Plains ADA Center, and the ADA Hospitality Initiative is coordinated by the Mid-Atlantic ADA Center.
Okay, and I'm in Pacific.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, those initiatives are national. They're not specific.
Okay. Okay. All right. Very good. Thank you for your help. I appreciate you taking the call.
Mm-hmm. Kelly, as we go next, this is a comment that was somebody submitted that is from the state of Michigan who just wanted to make people aware of the fact that they had a new service animal law that went into effect yesterday on the 18th of January, and it defines a service animal now as a dog or a miniature horse. That public act makes it a crime to refuse entry to a person using a service animal or to assault a service animal. It also exempts dogs from licensing fees if they are a service animal to someone with a disability or a veteran with a service-related disability. It also requires the Department of Civil Rights to offer voluntary identification for service animals and requires the department to receive reports of problems encountered by a person with a disability using a service animal. And it's also, interesting enough, makes it a misdemeanor to falsely represent a service animal and brings state law more in line with the ADA respect to the definition of who's a person with a disability, what is a service animal, and specifically has language permitting veterans to possess a service animal for post-traumatic stress disorder, or traumatic brain injury, or other service-related disability. So this is an FYI that somebody wanted to share with individuals. Again, I think you're seeing that states are making changes or doing different things to align state law with service animal language at the federal level. Is that correct?
Yeah. And I mean, it's so nice to hear this about Michigan. I'm quite hot off the presses. Yeah, I mean, states really are doing a lot of things, and there are some states that are making it, you know, misrepresenting either you. I think it varies what language some states use, but it's either misrepresenting if the animal is a service animal or falsely representing that you have a disability. Some of them are carry fines and jail time.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, on that same vein, there was a recent article, I'm sure DOJ heard about it, even though it was associated with the Air Carry Act Act, related to someone bringing a turkey and claiming it was a service animal onto an airline. And there was in the article, at least the article that crossed our office, was the discussion of the fact that the FTA is exploring potentially changing or modifying their rules and regulations in light of some of the abuse or at least the interpretation or the assumption of some abuse occurring with that to more closely align with the ADA where they have been different up to this point. Do you have any thoughts, or do you have any conversations or heard anything about that?
That is true. I would encourage folks to go to DOT's website. Let me see if I have it here. Hang on, because I might. You check over there, the top pile. I had to move one huge pile of stuff from my desk. You see the notice of the regs? Yeah, that's it. Let me see. Thank you. Let me tell you when this got publish and
On December 7th, DOT published a notice of intent, and it was non-discrimination on the basis of disability in air travel, consideration of a negotiated rulemaking process. So what I would encourage folks to do, and yes, the service animal issue is one that they're, they have identified as possible rulemaking subjects, in-flight entertainment, in-flight medical oxygen, fraud with relation to service animals, laboratories on new single aisle aircraft, and classes of service. But I would encourage you to look at that, and let me see what the date. Oh, please submit your comments no later than January 6th. But but I would have folks take a look because I think it may be of interest to folks, and if they do move forward with this negotiated rulemaking, people will have a chance to participate. But that's all I can really say on behalf of the Department of Transportation.
Great. That would be, that's great. So that's just, something that comes up, and there's always something out there, I guess, is what you want to say, right?
There is. Well, we went from the belly pig to the turkey, and it's my understanding that just from the newspaper account that I saw that there was actually a seat purchased for the turkey. And it was on an international flight, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think it was also, yeah.
That's a long flight, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I think you're right. It would be turkey. Okay, so there's another question. But let's just go back to that. I think long flights are going to be problematic even for a service dog, right? I mean, that's always a consideration, how long your service dog, can hold and do things, and manage gallbladder for international flights. Okay, so here's a question related to a concert again. So this is, again, a ticketing issue. The question is, can you offer seating at all levels for everyone? Are you also required to offer seating with a line of sight for people with disabilities in all levels as well? Or is the venue able to say that floor seating will not offer a clear line of sight, so we cannot offer accessible seating there? So they're not offering, they're saying no because there's not a clear line of sight on the floor, and they're not offering you even the option to come to a wheelchair accessible seat on the floor because they're saying it's not a clear line of sight.
It's the same line of sight everybody else sitting in that area gets, right? Or is it general admission or standing?
No, well, it says that basically the only information we've got here just from the webinar, from the input, is that we're seeing at all levels for everyone. But they're saying that they're not allowing wheelchair seating on the floor because it does not provide a clear line of sight. So,
if I can, if somebody can purchase a seat for floor seating, somebody with a disability, they should have that same access. If they're providing an accessible seat within that defined either the point of sale cost or location, then that's what they're required to do. But, they can't, maybe what they might be saying, and I'm not trying to second guess the questioner, is that we can't guarantee that you're going to have, a line of sight over standing spectators. I don't know what it is. But if they are offering different price points, different views, they need to offer those to the extent they can under things like readily achievable barrier removal. They need to offer those to people with disabilities the same as they would to other patrons that are buying those seats.
Okay. So, I think probably what they might be getting caught up in, is I don't know, is that they might be getting caught up in that, you know, the regs require a comparable line of sight, and so they may be saying that, you know, they may be interpreting it. I don't know. The venue may be interpreting it that somebody would not be able to see, and so they're not going to play with you because they don't want to get in trouble. I don't know that, but I'm just,
I think really the only time that's going to be an issue, and I'll tell you, one time I spent a lot of money, and it was a Horizon Center for like front row floor seating. I'll never do it again because I couldn't see the stage. But they offered me accessible seats in the same range as somebody else could. I should have the same chance of making a big fucking mistake like I did. Or, you know, the only thing I can see that that might be an issue is if there's no assigned seating and it's standing room only. But if there's assigned seats, everybody that is sitting down is going to have that same kind of view. That's a legal term. So I guess I'm not quite sure. There are always issues if the seating, the only real seating that is offered is toward the back or, you know, in loges and things like that, and that everybody on the floor is standing. So I don't know the circumstances, but if those are available for the rest of the population to purchase, they should be available for, again, remember the seating only applies to purchasing a ticket that essentially rents you a very specific seat, like J28 for that performance. That's the only thing that our ticketing requirements relate to. But you should be able to purchase those same as anybody else.
Okay, so then the person came back and provided clarification and said what they really wanted is, are they required to provide them a line of sight for wheelchair access on each floor? So while they're saying that they won't sell me one there because there isn't a line of sight, are they required to provide one on each level? If they're selling tickets on each level.
Yes. Well, I mean, here's what the language is, they have to provide comparable lines of sight.
Right. So it might not be if it's everybody standing.
That's the question. If it's people standing, you know, if
like
you're
a mosh pit.
That's right.
Yeah.
Robin, you know those terms, huh? but I mean, that's always the question. If people are standing. And whether they're standing at their seat, like, you know, at a, where you would, it's not an opera, let's say, where people, you wouldn't expect them to be jumping up and down during it. But there are a lot of kinds of events where people can stand. But they're required to offer you seating in the same locations that are available to others. In terms of the physical mismatch, there may be issues where they can't, in terms of an existing facility, let's just say Title III, or readily achievable barrier removal, they may not be able to provide you seats, you know, to the second balcony because there's no accessible route to it. And then they would have to make up for those seats in the nearest accessible location to that second balcony. But in terms of providing lines of sight, I think I'm a little confused. If everybody is standing and use a wheelchair, you're not going to see.
But that's compared to the line of sight to what everybody else is getting, because if I'm sitting in the back or whatever and I'm a short person, I'm not going to see.
That's right. So I mean, it's comparable to the line of sight other people have.
Yeah.
As yucky as it may be.
So, okay, let's move on because were you able to find that information on the Georgia GNET investigation?
Yes. Hang on.
Don't want to forget that one or leave that off.
Hang on. Okay. I'm going to tell you what I know. Hang on. Let me get to the top. We did, let me tell you when we did this. In July of 2015, we did a letter of finding. And this GNET is a Georgia Network for Educational Therapeutic Support. And this relates, this is a state system. And it was kind of under Title II. It involves the Georgia Department of Education. And here's where we are. The issue was that students with disabilities were not being provided access to the state's admission services and facilities, all of that stuff that relates to the entire program. GNET is a program, and that students on a statewide systemic issue were, this was for education therapeutic support services for kids who had behavior issues that were manifestations of their disability. And that it was our position that the state administered this program that resulted in essentially segregation of students with disabilities. And I'm trying to see just where we are, though, at the moment. That's what I'm trying to find. Hang on just one second. I want to find out exactly where we are. And the recommended remedial measures, this is on our website, and I have not looked at this forever, ever. And the idea here is that kids have to be placed, in order to receive these sort of, quote, special services on their, related to their disabilities, to make sure that it was the most integrated setting. Not physically apart from other students, not at other parts of a facility, and there were also, it was unnecessary placement. They kept kids in that system for a very long time. I would encourage folks who really want more information, because I know that was really pathetic, is to look online. And for our letter of finding to the governor and the attorney general of Georgia. It's United States Investigations of Georgia Network for Educational and Therapeutic Support. I did a terrible job on that, and I'm very sorry.
It's okay. Another question for you is, can you please give the status of where the federal agencies are on adopting or modifying their regulations to incorporate the definition of disability from Section
Nevada?
Correct.
No, I don't. Now,
I believe you had some regulations about yourself.
Yes. And the final rule the final rule is listed in the Unified Agenda as being next December. We are really moving in relation to 504. We're moving ahead. I know other agencies are moving ahead on that. And we have our own Amendments Act, Title II and Title III. And that should all hopefully be done very, very soon. But I don't know. I think here's what my understanding is.
is that other agencies are moving forward under 504, under federally conducted. But I can't tell you where they are as far as in the process of it.
And what agency is responsible for monitoring that?
We are.
Okay. RJ. Okay. I wasn't even, I don't think I thought I was sure about that. So, okay. Okay, we'll go back to the phone and see if there's any questions there. We're getting towards the end of the hour. We've got about 5 minutes left.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions or comments at this time, please press the star and then the one key on your touchtone telephone.
Okay, so I'm going to come back and again grab something from the webinar platform that somebody asked. Can you give some additional information in regards to when the Department of Justice will move forward on some of the other advance notice of proposed rulemaking that was issued in 2010 specific to you already had some discussion about the internet, but application to Title II versus Title III, and also the rulemaking regarding equipment, furniture, things of that nature?
Yes, I can tell you, but here's all I can tell you, is what is currently on the fall unified regulatory agenda. So that is the information that I can give you. So let me give you a quick rundown. I say the amendments act here. Title II web rule is listed for the NPRM January of 2016. Movie rule, final rule, May 2016. Title III web, the NPRM to be determined. The next generation 911, September of 2017, that was in NPRM. Equipment and furniture, NPRM, June 2018. Medical equipment, NPRM, December 2017. And hotel bed, and all it says here is April of 2017. It doesn't say whether it's going to be ANPRM or NPRM.
Just for clarification, people, NPRM is advanced notice of proposed rulemaking. It's where the Department of Justice identifies that they may be doing or engaging in rulemaking and asking certain questions for public comment. Notice of proposed rulemaking is putting out an actual notice that they are doing rulemaking in a particular area. Asking for public comment, just so people know the difference between the
two. And you know, I would encourage everybody out there, whenever there's an open comment period, it's really important that you comment. Don't assume that other people are going to do it. You know, when we did the 2010, the big revision, people commented, and every single comment gets reviewed. And if you don't believe me, look at the guidance and analysis that comes with the regulation, the Title II reg and the Title III, and it will talk about why we made the decisions we did, what specific parts of industry and constituencies raised certain issues, and why we changed something because of that. So I just can't encourage people enough that when there is an open comment period, please comment. It really is the time for your voice to be heard, and it does make a big difference. I should have left that soapbox.
Well, Just for clarification and for comment, we've seen some pressure, at least some comments that have been made by members of Congress about the issue of web accessibility rules and regulations and things of nature, and somewhat of, I don't want to say pressure, but definitely some comments about DOJ needing to move forward with that particular issue. From what you said, it was January of 2016, and we've seen that moved several times on the calendar. Do you have any sense of, since we are now more than halfway through this month, whether that's
still realistic in this month, or whether or not that's not realistic in this month.
It was a good try, Robin.
I know.
But I can't comment. And I did. I know that we have gotten the congressional letter. I just cannot comment. I'm not allowed to.
All right. Well, I did try.
It was valiant.
Yes. Thank you. All right. Well, we are at the end of our hour, unfortunately, our 90 minutes. Unfortunately, we do want to thank Sally for the time and honesty that she has put into responding to your questions and your concerns. We have some that we will be following up with based on some of the discussion that was had or some questions that were asked. So those of you that asked to follow up, we will be doing that with Sally for you on your behalf. So thank you, everyone, for participation today. You will be receiving a follow-up email after this session, which will give you some additional information about receiving your certificate of attendance, et cetera. We do not have our session able to announce for February, but please keep it on your calendar for the third Tuesday of February, and we will be announcing as soon as we get ready. We've got some final confirmations to be able to let that out at this point, and we apologize for that. And we will get back to you on that. So again, the email will also have evaluation information. Please fill that out if you are interested in your comments that's related to the session on the program as well. So again, Sally, thank you very much for your time today. Thank you, everybody, for your participation. And at this time, if you're on the phone, you can hang up. And if you're on the webinar platform, you can go ahead and close your browser, and that will close you out of the session. So again, have a good day, everybody.
Thank you.